This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is up on Center Stage, the show about the arts and the artists behind their work. Filmmaker Steven Spielberg said of his love of the world of cinema, "Every time I go to a movie, it's magic, no matter what the movie's about." To all of us who love film, we understand the deeper meaning. Well, my guest today is film historian, professor, and author Foster Hirsch, and he is the man who interprets the movies and their magic. And with 16 books on Hollywood to his name, he has earned the pedigree to speak about it. Foster is a professor of film at Brooklyn City College and a popular presenter at film festivals around the world. His latest book is Hollywood and the Movies of the 50s, covering a decade that was rich with films from directors such as Alfred Hitchcock and Douglas Sirk, and issues such as the Blacklist era and the end of the movie studio moguls. He and I first met at the home of legendary Hollywood agent Bud Moss. I sat back and listened as Bud and Foster looked back on Hollywood and shared their individual experiences, which thrilled me to the bone. So let's carry on with part two of my conversation with Foster Hirsch. We pick up with our discussion of film noir and Stanley Kubrick. Foster, you are a devotee and expert in the genre of film noir. You speak in Hollywood in the Movies of the 50s of Stanley Kubrick as a close student of film noir long before noir had been defined and categorized. I find this so fascinating.
Well, Kubrick loved the crime films out of the past of Double Indemnity. When those films were released and when he first saw them, they would not have been identified as noir. They would have been called suspense films or thrillers or crime films.
Interesting.
Film noir didn't get designated until the mid-40s when crime films were released in Paris after the war. But film noir as a descriptive term didn't gain currency in this country till long after the 50s. We use noir very easily now and everybody knows what it means. But in the 40s and 50s, the people who were making the films and enjoying the films would not have used that term.
Interesting.
They would have called them thrillers or crime movies.
And you say he went from making very immature films to suddenly springing onto the scene with The Killing and Paths of Glory.
Well, he was very lucky because he had United Artists behind him, mm-hmm. and they supported him for his first two films, which are no better than graduate school thesis films and not the best film school in the country.
Interesting.
They're pretty amateur night. There's no directorial credit. Looking at those films, I think you'd be shocked to see they were directed by Kubrick. They were his training ground films. They were his juvenilia, his apprenticeship. And then having made two bad films under United Artists, they stayed with him and produced and released The Killing, which is about a racetrack heist and is a masterpiece. Two films, and then you produce a masterpiece, and then you produce Paths of Glory, yeah. a masterpiece anti-war film. So obviously the genius was there. And thanks to Arthur Krim and Robert Benjamin, the lawyers who turned around and saved United Artists, they stuck by him. So it was a training ground for Cooper. It gave him an apprenticeship, an extraordinary kind.
And I feel that UA was also a training ground for independent filmmakers per se.
Absolutely. That was the beginning of the emergence of the independent filmmaking movement in America. Because the UA lawyers saw that the old system was on the way out.
Right.
And so they had to devise a new system. They became a kind of house for producers who had projects. They brought the projects to them. They gave the producers a lot of independence, but they didn't insist on 7-year contracts. The producers were free to come and go as they pleased. They operated as true independents.
Wow.
And then that became the way all films are made virtually.
Exactly.
So it became the model for the American film industry, set up by Arthur Krim and Robert Benjamin at United Artists in 1951.
Do you think they were just risk takers or were they futurists who could really see ahead?
They were shrewd businessmen
who
saw a financial model for a failing film industry.
Yeah, okay.
They said independent filmmaking is the model for the future.
Wow.
They were right.
You were absolutely
They were right.
right.
They were not themselves producers. They had no interest in filmmaking. They had no artistic skills or ability. They were brilliant lawyers who, in many ways, as much as Darryl Zanuck at Fox with CinemaScope, were responsible for saving an ailing industry.
Absolutely. Can I tell you my favorite chapter of your book?
Absolutely do.
It was actually the in-depth look into one of my favorite films, The Night of the Hunter, directed by Charles Laughton, starring Robert Mitchum. You have a way of speaking about this film that's so beautiful. I think you refer to it as a kind of fairy tale, a film noir fairy tale. And when I read that, I was like, bingo. I've always tried to explain that film or categorize it myself and was never able to. You know, the images, the very theatrical feeling about it, the sexuality of Robert Mitchum, and that firecracker script. What an achievement. But yet, everyone behind that film never did anything again. Well, Robert Mitchum obviously did, but Charles Laughton.
I go into great detail about the production history of that film and the immediate fallout. It was a huge failure when it was released in 1955. It was a critical failure and it was an artistic failure. I saw it at a matinee and I counted the number of people in the theater. There were 10 people.
Oh no.
Nobody went to see this film. If people went, they were puzzled. People sort of walked out in a daze. But even as a kid, I knew I'd seen a great film. And time has caught up with it. So for the film series that I've been co-curating to promote the book, the biggest success at every festival has been Night of the Hunter. People in tears, moved beyond almost description by the beauty of this film. And
It
it is
is.
hard to categorize because it has elements of film noir, it has elements of the horror film, it has elements of a fairy tale, it has elements of a coming of age, adolescent story. But it's more than all of those things put together. It's still ultimately beyond categorization. It's one of a kind.
Definitely one of a kind.
What, there's no other film like it. I'm very proud that I recognized its greatness in 1955. I recognized its greatness up to this past Monday when I introduced it at the end of the film, when I went up to do a Q&A with the audience. I almost couldn't begin speaking because the movie is so
Interesting.
incredibly moving and beautiful, a work of art. And none of the staff of the film had any success after. The screenwriter, James Agee, died 4 months before the film was released. The extraordinary composer, Walter Schumann, died a few years after the film's release. The intrepid editor, Robert Golden, never got another important assignment. Charles Laughton, because the film failed, never got a chance to direct another film. Paul Gregory, the producer, disillusioned, got out of Hollywood as fast as he could and retired, lived a long life in the desert, but never made another film but one. The only survivor from the film is the young girl who plays the child, and she won't talk about it.
She won't.
She will not talk about making the film. It was a traumatic experience for her. She's a teacher in Northern California, but she does not give interviews or make appearances in connection with the film, no matter what.
You know, during the early days of COVID, I read with glee Lee Server's biography of Robert Mitchum, Baby, I Don't Care. I was so thoroughly entranced with this man, Robert Mitchum. What a life he had. Even on a chain gang, as he trained across America, smoking marijuana and being arrested and always being the bad boy. But yet, he loved that experience of Night of the Hunter.
He knew this was the role of a lifetime. And indeed, he gives the performance of his career.
Yeah, he
One of
does.
the great performances in American movies. He goes beyond being Robert Mitchum. He could be a lazy actor and just coast by on being Robert Mitchum. He had so much presence and he
That's right.
oozed sexuality. He didn't have to work very hard. But in this film, he gives a real performance. And it's as good as it is because his adversary, he's evil, and his adversary, the essence of good, is played by Lillian Gish, whose dignity and beauty and pure all-American quality, all these qualities that she had, have never been used as powerfully as in that film. I think that's her greatest performance. So when you see these two representations of good on the one hand and evil on the other, and that's at some level what the film's about, struggle between good and evil, and good wins. embodied by these archetypal American actors.
Yes,
And
archetypal.
Charles Laughton, who believed in Robert Mitchum, who was difficult, and he did come to the set sometimes inebriated and didn't always remember his lines. Paul Gregory didn't want to use him. Charles Laughton insisted. And in later years, when Paul Gregory was asked, "Didn't you think Robert Mitchum was brilliant?" he said reluctantly, "Yes, he was very good in a well-written part, but he was only playing himself."
That's a pity, really, because I think he found his medius role.
That movie seemed to have almost a curse hanging over it, and I could only wish that all of its embattled creators were still alive to see the reception that this film has been getting now.
I agree.
Young audiences who cheer at the film's brilliance. It's an audacious film. It does things that no other American film of the time did, with all those German expressionist touches and theatrical stylings. It takes place in a world unlike any other. Yes, it's a real world, but not quite.
Yeah.
Someplace else, a limbo world.
But that is cinema, isn't it, Foster?
One of the great films. You hit a nerve when you mentioned that film, Pamela. That's one of my favorites as well.
The beauty in which you describe that is worth a reading for all my listeners out there. If you don't get through this 600-page book, go to the chapter on The Night of the Hunter. And I have to also say that Richard Brody in The New Yorker loved your devotion to the melodrama and Douglas Sirk. Can you comment on that, Foster?
Douglas Sirk is probably my favorite director, and I show Imitation of Life all the time, wherever I can, to students at film festivals last December to promote my book at the Egyptian in Hollywood, the American Cinematheque, with Susan Conner, Sarah Johnson, the only survivor of the film, there as our guest. I showed it to students last week for the last class, and I was worried, would they accept it? Would they like it? Would they shed tears? And I thought to myself, when I get a class that's skeptical about Imitation of Life or can't accept it or aren't moved to tears by its drama, probably time for me to retire from teaching. After 58 years in the classroom, it's probably time already, but I haven't done it yet. But
and
they
I don't
loved
think you will.
Imitation of Life. They loved it. One Black student came up to me after the film and said, "In the funeral scene, I was shaking."
Oh.
And he said, "I wasn't even realizing that I was shaking and the chair was moving until the student in front of me told me."
Wow.
So he was moved beyond himself.
It's so timely. It's interesting how these things come around in circles, isn't it?
And that film, unlike Night of the Hunter, was a huge financial success in 1959, but it wasn't taken seriously critically. It was considered a Lana Turner vehicle. She wears more costumes in that film than any other star in history had worn up to that point. It wasn't taken seriously. It was a ladies' matinee weepy. But over the years, it's been fully recognized as a brilliant artistic achievement by a great
Absolutely.
Director.
Is there a book about Douglas Sirk in your future?
That's a good question. I don't know if there are enough people around who can speak directly about him at this point, but he certainly deserves all the attention and praise and focus he can get.
This is so fascinating, Foster Hirsch. I'm loving it. I have like 10 million questions for you, and we don't have enough time. But one thing I want to talk about just briefly,
yes.
I find it fascinating that one of my favorite actors, Jimmy Stewart, was very clever about his career. It was long-lasting. He got out of typecast early on. He was adept at comedy, but he also turned his eye towards a genre I've always been interested in the 50s, which became psychologically very interesting, and that is the Western. And when he turned to do Anthony Mann's Westerns, he was trying to go in a different direction. And I feel as if he was maneuvering towards Hitchcock's Vertigo at that point.
Absolutely. Good point. When he started to make the Anthony Mann Westerns as early as 1950, he clearly wanted to overturn his, by that point, stereotyped image as Mr. Smith. Mr. Smith goes to Washington, a kind of hayseed, naive country boy with a drawl, that he was typecast in a certain way and the range was pretty narrow. He wanted to play darker characters. He wanted to play characters you didn't necessarily like. He wanted to play characters who were driven by some sort of inner psychic wound, and sometimes who had external wounds as well. And the Anthony Mann Westerns gave him that platform. And that, I think you're very right, that moved him in the direction of the great Hitchcock films that he made, in which he played neurotics.
Yes.
He's a neurotic character in Rear Window, and certainly in Vertigo. That character is something of a misogynist. He's physically incapacitated, which reflects some sort of psychological or emotional limitation. And he is willing to change his stripes. And it was a very smart career move, because then he wasn't done with it when the 50s were over. He still had another 20 years. He lasted longer almost than any other actor of his stature, I think, because of his willingness to change. An actor I talk about in the book who had a good run in the 50s, but he was absolutely unwilling to change his stripes, was Clark Gable.
Yes.
Who was playing sexy heroes until the end, and who wasn't really willing to darken his image. He wanted to be Clark Gable's superhero. In one movie, which everybody's supposed to hate, called Band of Angels, which he plays the master of a plantation, I feel watching the film that the actor is sort of startled by all the acting expected of him to play this part. You know that film?
Yes, I do.
Band of Angels, in which he plays a complicated character, but somebody who tries to break down racial barriers. It's a complex part. It can't be played by a Clark Gable movie star. It has to be played by an actor willing to explore psychological depths and complexities and ambiguities. And he does it. He does it. I think it was the only time almost in his career that he does do that. And he's very good in it.
I'll be darned. I'm going to have another look at that now with a different perspective.
It's a film that everybody's supposed to hate, and there's plenty of material to hate about it. But it's the only film of the 50s that really deals in a substantive way with the dangerous subject of slavery in the South. It's set on a plantation, and it deals with issues about slavery. So it's a challenging film, but as I say, there's something for everyone to hate and complain about.
I love that. That's on my list. I feel that I really need to apologize to you right now that we haven't even touched on McCarthyism and the Blacklist era, which actually is a definite thread in your book. And your investigation into that is so thought-provoking that it has left me feeling that I wasn't actually reading about film, but I was reading about history, as punctuated by this band of misfits in Hollywood.
Well, as I did research for The Blacklist, because that's an important part of Hollywood in the 50s, I realized I needed to go deeper than I thought I was expecting to. And so I did more reading and more thinking, and it became a longer section of the book than I had originally thought. One reader said, it's too long, you should cut some of that. But actually, I don't agree with that. I think what I write about The Blacklist, I really considered it carefully, and I asked myself this question, which I think any contemporary reader needs to ask. If I was there in Blacklist Hollywood period, how would I have acted? What would I have done? Isn't it easy in hindsight and not being there to say, well, of course I would have acted fairly and responsibly and done the right thing? But I'm not sure I can answer that. I'm not sure I would have passed every test with flying colors. It's very easy to say, this is right and this is wrong. These people did the right thing. These folks did the wrong thing. I think it's much more complex than that. And I finally came to some conclusions about where my politics are in relation to this vexed period. And I share that with the reader. But it came to me only after I'd done a lot of thinking and research and then reflected and connected my thinking about The Blacklist to the movies that were produced during that time, which were either directly or metaphorically, allegorically, about the tensions engendered by The Blacklist.
Yes, yes. I do invite all of my listeners to really pick up Foster Hirsch's book. Just this alone is worth the investment. This is so important, you know, for our real personal freedoms and our integrity.
But it was complex, not to answer it now, but the moguls I write about in that opening section of the book met together at the Waldorf Post Hotel in 1947. They instituted the Blacklist on their own industry. The government didn't do it. The government wanted them to do it, but they were independent entities. They instituted the Blacklist. Why? Can you understand why they made the decisions that they did? That's not for us to discuss now. That's the question the book asks.
Exactly. Wow. Thank you for sharing all that. You know, I've just got to say one last comment about an actor who I found in the film The Searchers to finally come to grips with a complex character, and that is John Wayne. I'm a big fan of that film. I believe that visually it's magnificent. I think the grief and the horror and the hatred and the anger that John Wayne we see on the film against the backdrop of Monument Valley, which is indelible in our minds, and of course, the great John Ford. It wrestles with so many topics.
And in such a sophisticated way. I just had arguments with students this semester about The Searchers, and I was saying I thought they misread the film. The film does not advocate for the John Wayne character.
No.
It's not a film that takes his point of view. The film is about a character who suffers from racist attitudes. So it's a film about racism. I would argue against those who claim it is a racist film. There's a difference. It's a film about racism. And remember, the John Wayne character does not enter the house at the end of the film.
That's right.
He knows he cannot become part of this integrated community. He knows he's an outsider. He's gone as far as he can. He doesn't kill his niece Debbie when he finally finds her. He picks her up and says, let's go home.
Yeah.
He's changed. He leaves his money to his nephew, Martin, who's 1/8 Cherokee.
He has
changed in the course of the film. We understand that change. But he hasn't changed simplistically or miraculously. It's
Very
a film that deals with a hardcore racist. It offers reasons for why he would hate the indigenous population. There are reasons why they represented a real threat and they kill his family.
It's a very difficult film for me to
watch.
It's
a difficult film.
Yeah.
It's difficult. It asks hard questions and it does not arrive at an easy or tidy solution.
No, it doesn't.
I feel it is not a racist film.
No,
It's a film about racism.
I agree.
Two different statements.
And again, in the hands of John Ford, the epic feel of a very psychologically very deep, penetrating storyline is so well worked out, I feel.
Wonderfully worked out. The only thing I don't like about the film are the touches of Irish humor. I'm not Irish. What John Ford finds funny, I don't. I understand that the comedy scenes are there to provide some variety and to lighten the load a bit, but to me, they're not funny.
But in the films, the Westerns of the 1950s, you know, The Searchers, Shane, and High Noon, we're going into another arena, and it's challenging the moviegoer, which I just find so gratifying.
Those are the three great Westerns, in my opinion, in the American repertory. And if I could launch off from that, what I find so rich about the period and what never disappointed me as I kept revisiting it, you have some of the best examples of almost every genre. To me, Imitation of Life is the greatest of all movie melodramas. Ben-Hur, 1959, the greatest of all epic films. Science fiction films, incredible. Shrinking Man, Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Yeah.
These are wonderful movies. There isn't much in the horror film, and comedy was not great in the 50s. I'll grant that. But in so many other genres, musical, The End of the Great Musical, Singing in the Rain, American in Paris, Bandwagon, Seven Brides for Seven Brothers, a
That's
problematic
right.
film.
I know we haven't even spoken about On the Waterfront and the great Marlon Brando, and of course, Some Like It Hot, which I think these two films stand on their own as being such genius films. But I want to ask you a personal question. If you could meet at least one filmmaker who has passed away and you could have a long and lingering dinner, who would it be and why?
That would be Douglas Sirk.
There you go.
I would want to talk about what he did to layer his melodramas with such nuance and such artistry. And did he know that in the course of time, the melodramas that were popular in the 50s but dismissed and looked down upon, did he know that ultimately they would receive the attention of academics and historians and reach their proper due? Did he know in the end he was going to be artistically justified?
I'd like to be at that
dinner
table.
Yes, I suspect he would have said yes. If he were here, I would want to engage with him.
Foster Hirsch, I have to ask you one more question. If there is one word or phrase that describes who you are to the depth of your soul.
I do think I have the gift not to be bored. I've never been bored.
You see, again, that's like you saying these movies were patient with us, and you're being patient with us by that turn of phrase. I love that, Foster. And it's true. It's totally true.
I never bored in my life. Or what am I going to do? How am I going to fill the time?
Yeah,
I know how to use my time and to enjoy it.
Yeah.
And to enjoy it.
That's the beautiful balance then.
I hadn't thought it, but you asked the question. I would stand by that.
I think that's wonderful.
He was never bored. That'd be the final word. He was never bored. I was never bored.
Well, I'm so excited to have had you on my show, Foster Hirsch. Thank you so much for gracing Center Stage. You are a lecturer, presenter, a respected scholar, author, and professor of film. Everyone, I want you to go to fosterhirsch.inc, as in I-N-K, which I think is just so beautifully put, and find more out about this fascinating man and his life in the movies. And I, for one, Foster, you've really encouraged me to look further backwards all the time. So I'm going to go right to that Otto Preminger book of yours. I haven't read that yet. I hope you'll come on Center Stage again.
Absolutely.
All the best with the book, Hollywood and the Movies of the 50s, right hot off the press.
Easy to find in bookstores and, of course, on Amazon.
Of course, always. All right, Foster, all the best to you. Please come back and visit. Thanks. And we'll talk more. And to everyone out there, I hope you'll still embrace the magic of films, but by all means, go to the movies, because there's nothing like a darkened theater, the smell of popcorn, the velvet chairs, and if you can find an independent theater, and of course in this area, that would be the Avon Theater in Stamford, Connecticut. And I hope you'll flock there. Just go and watch whatever is on, because you'll be better off for it, and the magic of the movies. Foster Hirsch, thank you again. And to everyone, stay safe out there. This is Pamela Kuhn, and the curtain is now down on Center Stage.